Great. Good afternoon, finally. My name is Tom Green with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Just a few introductory comments I want to give to the folks that will be leading the questions for us this afternoon. Firstly, this is being conducted in accordance with the statute that created the commission. Basically, our task is to do a diagnosis of the financial crisis, what happened, and then report back to the Congress and the President later in mid-December of this year. So we are not prosecutors. We're basically trying to sort out what happened. So one of the implications of that is we ask both narrow questions about, in your case, your employment with Goldman, but we may also well ask you broader policy questions. We hope you can be as responsive as possible with respect to both. We have not sworn you in, as might happen in a deposition, as may have happened to you in the past. But I do need to indicate to you, advise you, that since we are federal investigators, there is a statute that applies, 18 U.S.C. 1001, which basically penalizes anyone who speaks untruthfully to a federal investigator. So I didn't want to let you know that there were stakes here. In the event that any of our questions are not clear, please stop us, ask us to make them clearer for you, and this is a conversation as opposed to a major examination, so we really want to get it right. We are recording this conversation, so when you answer, try and answer verbally. Try and stay away from nods or shaking of the head, and we'll try and prompt you to make sure that you do say something verbally, but if you would keep that in mind, we'd appreciate it. If you need to take a break for a personal reason, or if you want to consult with your attorneys, just let us know. We'll certainly take a break immediately and allow you to take whatever time seems appropriate. Let me just introduce my colleagues. Tom Stanton is with our research group. Tom is somebody that tends to ask the bigger questions. Carl McCartan is with our investigative staff. He's a financial expert for us. Kim Schaefer, down at the end, is also with our research staff, and he is an expert in some of the securities that you've worked on. Chris Seifer will be joining us momentarily. He had to take a call, and will probably be one of the people asking most of the questions this afternoon. So let me turn it over to Carl.
Hi. Thanks again for joining us today. I guess as standard practice, we always like to get a sense of your background. So could you walk us through your work experience from college up through present?
Certainly. I graduated from Princeton University in 1992. I had a degree in aerospace engineering. I began my employment with what was then referred to called Anderson Consulting, since renamed to Accenture. That's the name it's currently known. And that was business systems consulting work. I did that work through approximately July 1996. And then I went to business school at the University of Chicago, where I obtained in 1998 an MBA with a concentration in finance, and as well as a separate concentration in business economics. My summer employment between the first and second year of business school was as a summer associate in the Goldman Sachs fixed income rotational program. I received an offer in the fall at the conclusion of the program to join Goldman Sachs in the mortgage research area, which I then commenced when I graduated after a break. I joined Goldman in the summer of 1998, where after an initial training period for new associates generally, I also did some training in the mortgage research function and was asked to focus on the commercial mortgage area, which I did for the balance of 1998, 1999, and approximately the first half of 2000. Again, doing research regarding, speaking with customers about views on the commercial mortgage market, trade thoughts for institutional customers of Goldman. Then in 2000, I was asked to join a desk that was had just recently been formed, which was the CDO desk within the mortgage department. This was a new securitization origination business to originate asset-backed and mortgage-related CDOs. So my function in that group was as a structurer and as a an originator. So I would speak to asset managers that were seeking to do CDOs of asset and mortgage-backed securities. Worked in that capacity through the end of 2003. And then in the early part of 2004, I was given the opportunity to start a new trading desk within our there was a transition period. Initially, in 2004, I was still part of the CDO group. It was called the Structured Product Correlation Trading Desk. And then over the course of 2004, that desk, you know, was moved into the trading business after we had started it. So by the conclusion of 2004 and going into 2005 and subsequently, I was a part of what we call Structured Products Trading Group, and within that was a member of the Structured Products Correlation Trading Desk. That business, subsequently renamed as a result of some market reorganizations and the market events, as well as I got promoted to managing director at the end of 2007. I neglected to mention I was promoted to vice president in December 2001. So I joined as an associate. I was promoted vice president in December 2001. And then at the conclusion of 2007, managing director. We now call this business that was previously called the correlation trading business, now referred to as CDO and derivatives business. So it includes correlation trading. It includes cash trading of CDO ABS for both ABS as well as commercial real estate related CDOs, as well as we do certain derivative trades versus SPVs is a good way of describing it. So for instance, Lehman bankruptcy estate or other parties that wish to unwind derivatives facing structured vehicles, we also do some business where we compete in that market to unwind derivative trades. So that thing brings you to the present.
Okay. And you're still serving as capacity?
That's correct. I head the CDO derivatives trading desk within our mortgage department.
Which was formerly known as the correlation trading?
Well, the correlation trading desk, some additional activities accreted to me. So, you know, our CDO business, the origination business of CDOs ceased in 2007, but the trading activities were folded into my desk, as well as we incrementally started doing these types of derivative trades that I described, beginning in the 2008-2009 period that I recall. And so those were incremental activities that we did. So that's why we renamed the desk, because it was more than just CDOs.
It's actually like a little more clarification, if you would, between origination and clarification of what trading activities started in 08 that you just mentioned.
Sorry, in 08?
I thought you said.
Yes, we
started in 08.
Yes, in 08, we ceased CDO origination activity over the course of 2007 as the market dissociation. So that activity was not going on at that time. However, the trading activity of cash CDOs in the secondary market continued. And so that activity, which had not been previously under my supervision, became part of.
Okay. And CLOs were not part of your activity?
That's correct. To be precise, we do have some CLO exposures in my trading book as a result of CLOs being included as collateral securities.
Okay.
In certain abacus transactions.
Okay.
So we do have exposure, and we have traded them as a result of those exposures, but I'm not a market maker in CLOs.
Okay. And the sort of corporate synthetics is also a different desk.
That's correct.
Okay. I'm part of the research group, which works together with the investigative group, but my questions are going to be of a different character and much bigger picture, if you will, and more plumbing your opinions based on your view and experience in the marketplace. However, a little bit before we start with those questions, I'd like a little more background on how you define correlation trading and how that business started, if it's all right.
No, it's really your territory.
I think that would help in setting a backdrop for, so I ask you more appropriate questions.
Okay, certainly. We used the term correlation trading in with respect to this activity, and again, it's called the structured product correlation trading. Structured product was the term that was used by Goldman at the time to refer to securitizations generally, so mortgage-backed securities, whether RMBS or CMBS, asset-backed securities, as well as CLOs at the time. So this was all part of a group called the Structured Products Group, which at one point was headed by both Dan Sparks and Greg Mount, and then subsequently just Dan Sparks. So that was the name of the group. So we were focused on the trading of tranche credit protection, both buying and selling, of tranche credit protection referencing portfolios that consisted of these structured products. So again, mortgage-backed securities, asset-backed securities, and CDOs and CLOs. So everything within the gamut of structured finance.
I'm looking for whether there's some magic to calling it correlation trading as opposed to just secondary market trading of CDO tranches and ABX and et cetera.
I see. Well, the the nomenclature correlation trading that we used, I think, was similar to how our corporate correlation trading used it, which was partial capital structure, tranche synthetic transactions that reference these portfolios. So, as distinct from a full capital structure, CDO origination, or cash secondary trading business.
But within your area, there was both the fully banked deals and the correlation deals where it was only some certain tranches.
Not precisely. I was part of the fully banked CDO group from the period in 2000 that I described through approximately the end of 2003. In early 2004, we started this correlation group, which, as I was trying to describe, in the very earliest stages as we were setting it up, was still technically part of the CDO group, but then it became plugged into what we referred to as structured products trading because we were making markets and it was not an origination function. And so that CDO origination group persisted and continued to exist under the structured products group. But during the period 2005 through the earliest part of 2007, I was not part of that CDO origination group. And there was subsequent to the middle of February 2007. So again, subsequent to the middle of February 2007, there was a period of time where I was reporting not only to the heads of the structured product trading group, but also for a period of time to Pete Ostrom, who headed our CDO, structured product CDO origination group. That persisted for a period of time as well in the middle of 2007.
Thank you. We've done his background, and I was really seeking some clarifications on his background related to the start of the correlation trading book activities and sort of how that fit into other areas.
Okay.
I'd actually rather let you go and ask questions and save mine to the end because I think it builds well.
Okay.
Better.
So I take it the background included your time at Goldman, your various positions at Goldman, yes?
That's correct.
Okay. Did it cover the genesis of the Abacus CDOs?
No.
Okay. Tell us about the genesis of the Abacus CDOs, please.
Sure. The first Abacus CDO transaction was called 2004-1, which closed in July of 2004. That transaction was the result of an inquiry from a German customer, IKB Deutsche Industry Bank, which is based in Dusseldorf. That was a customer that expressed an interest in making an investment in a portfolio of structured product reference obligations that was going to be bespoke. So I'll use that term a couple times, might as well define it.
I understand it.
Okay. So again, just not to belabor it, but customized transaction portfolio structure, negotiated pricing, bilateral negotiation. And this that discussion with IKB began, I don't recall exactly at what point in 2004, but I recall that as, beginning in April 2004, we were conducting our own analysis of, how we would structure this transaction and ultimately completed the transaction for closing in the early part of July 2004.
Okay. Now, we know from the documents that have been produced that there were several Abacus transactions. Were the reasons for all those the same? An investor wanting to invest in a tranche of a structured product, and that was the way to go about doing it?
No, they weren't. They weren't all the same.
Okay. It explained to me. Let me ask you this: were they all client driven?
Yes, I think that's fair to say that they actually were all client-driven.
Okay. Did Goldman always take the initial short position on the Abacus trades?
Goldman was the protection buyer in all of the Abacus transactions with respect to the SPV. So in the first instance, we were the protection, providing the credit risk to the transaction.
Okay. So and unlike Ms. Schaefer, who worked at Bear Stearns and understands this stuff, I do not. So help me understand what I don't understand. If an IKV wants to come in and take a long position in the tranche of a structured transaction, and you do that via a synthetic CDO, why does that require... Well, let me ask you this. Does that mean that the short position that Goldman takes initially is just in the amount of the cash investment?
The answer to your question was generally yes, but there's some examples of variance that may differ from that. So how shall I best address your question?
Well, actually, let me ask you this, because it actually presumes something that I don't know is true. When IKB comes in 2004 and wants to make that investment, are they, in fact, buying a cash note within the Abacus CDO, or are they going long CDS on one of the tranches?
In the case of the Abacus SPVs, the investors, such as IKB, purchase notes.
Okay. So the 2004-4 deal that you mentioned in July of 2004, their cash investment in that deal was effectively the same as their structure anyway. It's the cash investment in the Paulson deal that I know about simply because of the SEC lawsuit.
I would say that the structures were substantially similar in the key legal respects. It was a 144A offering of a Reg S offering of a note. okay. from an SPV.
So in what circumstance, you said generally, you know, Goldman's short position would be equal to the long cash investment, but not all the time. So yeah. what were the circumstances where that wouldn't be the case?
Well, first I want to be precise about that. The cash investment, let's say IKB purchased $100 million of notes in the very initial issuance of the Abacus 2004-1 transaction. So the notional amount of the credit default swap in relation to that note issuance would also equal $100 million. Now, I do want to be precise that the, you know, so the notional amount of the trade would be $100 million, but because this was a tranche credit default swap, you know, depending on the risk measures you were using, the it would be recorded in our books and records as a trade of $100 million, but it may represent the risk of more than or less than $100 million of the underlying portfolio because of the tranching. So I just want to make sure that we're talking apples to apples, that the notional amount of Goldman's credit protection purchase for short was equal to the amount of IKB's note. But these instruments had a degree of either leverage or deleverage as a function of their tranche. Now, the specific sense in which I said there was a counterexample to your question, though, pertains to one transaction that I recall, which is Abacus 2005-7, which was what is referred to in the nomenclature as a levered super senior transaction, which was a very common instrument in corporate synthetic CDOs, although less common in mortgage-related CDOs. The idea of a levered super senior transaction, again, speaking generally, and I'll refer to the specific transaction, was that a customer would purchase a note, for instance, $100 million of a note. The credit default swap pertaining to that note would be some multiple of that $100 million, and effectively the $100 million would be like an initial margin on a larger credit default swap. And the way the structure would work is that if certain triggers with respect to either ratings or the market value of the contract, the CDS contract, exceeded some threshold, then the customer would have a choice of either putting additional capital into a transaction or walking away from the transaction. So this was a very specific structure that occurred in this particular Abacus transaction. The underlying reference portfolio was AAA CMBS. The credit default swap referenced the 10 to 100 layer of that portfolio. I recall that the in that transaction, $130 million of notes were distributed to the various investors, and that the magnitude of the credit default swap was 10 times. So it was that $130 million. Was equivalent to a credit default swap of $1.3 billion.
Right. And would the Paulson deal be a similar example of that?
No, Paulson deal did not have a levered super senior structure.
Okay, so then I'm missing something, because when I look at the Paulson deal, I see a face amount of all the tranches of $2 billion. I see $192 million cash investment on the A1 and A2 notes, mm-hmm. but I see $1.2 billion in credit default swaps.
Well, the $2 billion that you're referring to was not actually the reference portfolio amount with respect to the issued notes. It was a number that was presented on the marketing book and on the term sheet and the offerings, not the initial offering circular, to give a suggestion as to the max amount of notes.
Right.
That would be available. However, if you look at the specific credit default swap pertaining to the Class A2 notes and the Class A1 notes that were ultimately issued, the reference portfolio amount on those specific tranches was less than $2
billion. Right. Okay. But here's what I'm not understanding, and you can jump in, too, if you want, if it's just me. And if so, we'll move to another topic.
These kind of tricks.
I understood everything you said on the Paulson Abacus deal, at least I think I did. And I guess what I'm still not understanding is, well, let's go to the 2004 deal and maybe I'll understand it. Or I'm sorry, the 2005-7 deal, maybe I'll understand it that way. So the customer comes in and buys, makes a cash $100 million investment for the A1 note, let's say. I mean, I haven't looked at the deal, so I don't know which specific note it was. You're telling me the CDS was a multiple of that $100 million. Does that mean that somebody bought CDS on that tranche where the $100 million cash investment was for a multiple of $100 million?
I'm sorry, I didn't follow the question.
Damn it.
Well, the 057 transaction I introduced because it was a counterexample that I could think of to your question, right, which was, I recall that the size of the notes placed pertained to the size, it was equal and opposite to the size of Goldman's short, speaking colloquially, with respect to the credit protection purchase. So the reason I introduced 2005-7 was because it was the counterexample that I can recall with respect to that.
Okay. So Goldman's short on the 2005-7 deal, let's just assume it was $500 million. It was a multiple of five. I don't know what it was. But is that what you meant by being a multiple of the deal? I mean,
in that particular transaction, the multiple was 10 times.
Okay. So there's $1 billion short position that Goldman takes initially in that deal, correct?
The notional amount of the credit default swap was 10 times the notional of the credit link notes placed in that specific transaction. That was not the case for other transactions, analogous transactions.
And so were those CDS then, for example, just on those tranches where notes were purchased as opposed to, for example, on an unfunded super senior tranche?
Well, if I understand the question correctly, the notes also referenced the same super senior layer. So it was not that the notes referenced a different tranche, but I'm not sure I understood your question correctly.
Yes, I'm just demonstrating my ignorance here. Let me
suggest for your consideration that you choose one of several deals on the table and have them walk through the timeline of development of who approached them with what interest in what position and how they decided to create on the liability side what they did and how those were structured, and then also on the asset side the timing of the creation of those exposures.
Sure. And that's, thank you, Ken. And you know, pick the deal you remember the best and walk us through it.
Okay. In no particular order, just the one I remember the best.
Well, you probably want one though, where the CDS was larger than the cash investments, though, right?
It doesn't matter.
Well, just so I understand the context, right? When I refer to the CDS equaling the cash, every cash credit link note pertaining to an Abacus placement had a CDS associated with it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, for what I was attempting to convey clearly was that for every Abacus transaction that I can recall involving credit link notes, for every transaction except 2005-7, the notional amount of the CDS associated with that note equaled the principal amount of that note.
Okay.
And I guess his question, though, was if you look at AC1, there's more CDS than there is cash investment, so how is that?
Because of a separate unfunded super senior CDS. Okay. Outside of the SBA.
That, right. That's what I thought. And obviously, okay. I was talking past you and not understanding what you were saying, and I apologize for that.
Okay. So, I think I understand that now, and thank you. And I still want you to do what Kim suggested and just sort of walk us through, you know, how these deals, you know, begin and end.
Okay. Again, it varied by deal. But
if I may suggest, just there's CDS on both the liability and the assets or the collateral side, as you know, and Goldman can intermediate on either. So just try to keep the labels in there of asset or liabilities. You're an engineer. I'm sure you'll do a fine job.
I'll try my best. Well, I think the first one to start with would just be the very first one if I didn't explain it in enough detail already. And I can describe more if you wish. So in the very first Abacus transaction, as I mentioned, we learned I was told by, I recall it was Greg Mount, who was one of the co-heads of the group, that he had been traveling and that he had learned, I don't know how he learned, that IKB was interested in doing a bespoke CDO ABS trade. And so we contacted the salesperson to understand what their inquiry was. And I want to give some background on this because I think it's very helpful to understand the situation. IKB was already a customer that was known to us as being a large investor in CDO of ABS. They had purchased a large block of a CDO transaction in 2003 that was managed by Putnam, that had been underwritten by Goldman. And in that transaction, they also expressed an interest in, and I was involved in structuring that transaction, or being one of the team of structurers in that transaction. I mentioned this was when I was a CDO structurer, and so I was familiar with it, that they had said, we want to sponsor a transaction where we are the investor. We're not going to be a named party on the transaction, but we wish to purchase a block of $100 million of notes in a transaction that meets our criteria. And in fact, they also said, we'd like to do a transaction where Putnam is going to be the portfolio manager for that transaction. But they were concerned historically, in my experience at the time as a CDO of ABS investor, because they like to invest in very large size, $100 million being a relatively large investment size. However, they had a very rigorous and time-consuming approval process in their organization, so that frequently the time that it took for them to do their credit analysis and get their approvals meant that they were unlikely to participate in syndicated transactions because they couldn't accomplish two objectives. One, if it was a transaction shown to them in a syndicated format, they may not first like the aspects of the transaction or certain aspects of the transaction, so they may have to pass on it. And if they liked it, they couldn't guarantee that they got their target size of investment because they were competitively bidding against other investors in a syndication. So the concern that they expressed to us as early as 2003 was, well, we want to make sure that the trade is going to meet our criteria and that we're going to get our investment target size of $100 million. And in fact, I believe my recollection is they signed a letter agreement that they would effectively commit to purchase as long as it met their criteria.
Did that become more or less standard practice in the Abacus program, that when someone came in with reverse inquiry that they signed some sort of forward purchase?
No, I wouldn't refer to standard practice. The IKB would, in my recollections, they would sign a purchase letter on the pricing date of the transaction. They would not sign a letter prior to that.
So there was no written agreement?
I don't recall any written understanding that they would be compelled to purchase something other than on the pricing date of the trade date of the transaction.
By securities laws, they probably couldn't be compelled, but,
sometimes
there could be some documented arrangement so that if you went through all this trouble of creating something to their specifications and then they walked away.
I don't recall that we had any letters with any investors like that for Abacus transactions.
Okay.
With one exception, I'll refer to some of the managed Abacus transactions in a moment, where there were some features that I can talk about that as an example, but it was not precisely as you described, but it's worth pointing out for completeness. IKB had expressed this interest in 2003. They did a cash transaction in that instance. We also were aware, just from general knowledge, that they were a significant investor in corporate synthetic CDOs at the time. And so the reason I'm giving this background is the way they explained the reason for their inquiry to us was that they wanted to translate the benefits that they saw of a bespoke synthetic CDO, which they were doing on the corporate side, to see if that could be replicated on the mortgage and asset-backed side, so that they could, you know, pursue their objective of increasing their investment in the mortgage space. And I think it's important to note that during this time period, post Enron, WorldCom, et cetera, there were a number of investors who were interested in moving away from corporate credit risk, where there had been some volatility, and viewed the mortgage space as a more attractive space for investment during this time period. So this was the background that they described to us for the first Abacus transaction. They expressed an interest in a portfolio that would be what was referred to in the mortgage-related CDO market as a high-grade CDO. So this was a portfolio that was predominantly AA in its ratings, with some allocation to single A and some allocation to AAA ratings. And the portfolio was selected to have some exposure to subprime RMBS, conduit CMBS, consumer asset backs, by which I mean I recall credit card ABS and student loan ABS as being among the components in the consumer ABS, as well as allocation to structured finance CDOs, including CLOs. So this was a portfolio that had a variety of structured finance securities represented in it. The reference portfolio for that transaction was $2 billion in initial notional amounts, and IKB purchased $100 million of notes, I recall, in a tranche that attached, I recall it was 2.25% attachment point, which was a BBB rating. And I don't recall exactly where they detached. But to give you a sense, this was a...
And you did get a rating on that?
That transaction was rated by Moody's and S&P with public ratings. The issuance was a 144A Reg S offering. And I should mention that, again, for completeness, since you asked me to walk through that transaction, there were notes that were issued that were rated BBB, single A, double A, and single A. IKB purchased the entirety of the notes rated AA and below, and a portion of the AAA rated notes. The transaction was authorized to issue more AAA notes to fill out the capital structure. IKB didn't purchase. They wanted to invest $100 million in total, so they didn't invest all of the AAA notes. They only purchased a portion. And then subsequently, I don't recall over what time period, whether it was 04 or whether it went into 05, but notes were subsequently sold to TCW, Trust Company of the West, as well as to Wachovia, a Wachovia principal investing arm. So they purchased, those two entities purchased, I believe, $95 million of additional notes.
So the timing between when you first had some in-depth conversations with IKB, once you like really understood what they wanted, when did you start on the asset side? I still call them assets because I come from the cash world, but on accumulating the CDS shorts and sort of walk through the timing of that, please.
I'm sorry. If I understood the question, yes. When did we accumulate the?
Well,
because we didn't. I recall we started working on arranging the transaction. April is my earliest recollection of 2004. We may have started a bit earlier, and that's when I recall that we were working on conversations with outside counsel to actually arrange it. But we did not have, if I understood your question correctly, there was no CDS market for mortgage and asset-backed securities that was observable. We had observed a few specific trades that had been done by Morgan Stanley with one of our customers who showed it to us that were single name credit default swaps. But this was still a very immature market in 2004. So I want to make sure I understood your question correctly.
So I don't know the mechanics of this, which is showing in my question. So on the closing date for executing the trade with IKB was the same date that you entered into, that Goldman Sachs or an affiliate thereof entered into a CDS taking the short side of the entire reference portfolio. Is that how it worked?
Not the short side of the entire reference portfolio, but on the closing date of the transaction, the closing date of the transaction where the notes were issued and settled was the effective date on a tranche credit default swap having the same $100 million notional amount as the notes issued that referenced that layer of the reference portfolio to which IKB's notes were exposed. And that trade in the first instance was a short position that Goldman Sachs took with respect to that transaction. We did not, on that exact same date, have credit default swaps or other hedges taking a long position to offset that short position. Over a later period of time, as the market developed for single name credit default swaps, we did sell protection on various items in the reference portfolio to customers as well as other desks within Goldman Sachs. But the reason I wanted to respond to your question that way was that the reference portfolio was $2 billion in that trade. The credit default swap initially was $100 million. So this was a tranche that was $100 million notional. So the max loss to IKB would be $100 million. They didn't have exposure to more than $100 million. But it took a tranched levered position in the $2 billion portfolio.
Now I'm confused. I understand the tranching on the liability side, but on the other side, to get, maybe it's just I come from the cash world, so I'm missing something. But I thought you would have to. I don't understand how you have tranching on your short on Goldman Sachs' short positions on the reference portfolio.
Well, this is, I think, a good question. It's the reason for the nomenclature correlation trading, and the exact same situation is present in corporate synthetic CDOs, which was a much larger and more developed market.
Yes.
I have background in the full capital structure finance that you do as well, so I think I understand the tension there. The correlation trading would involve the buying or selling of tranched credit protection. Now, if you do a tranched credit protection purchase, such as Abacus 2004-1, and you look at the position, assume there's no other hedges that have been done, the trade that you have is that the customer is buying a note at par, in this case, where they're getting a coupon of LIBOR plus whatever, LIBOR plus 100. And Goldman Sachs was paying in a credit default swap coupon of also approximately 100, and the LIBOR was coming from the... I'm oversimplifying the structure a little bit for the ease of exposition. Goldman would be paying on a credit default swap the 100 basis points in on a credit default swap referencing the same layer. So the assets of the SPV would be, if IKB bought $100 million of notes, that $100 million of proceeds would stay in the SPV held by the trustee in a separate account to purchase AAA collateral securities that would yield a coupon reference to LIBOR. And the other assets of the vehicle would be the credit default swap to Goldman, selling protection to Goldman, which would be generating this monthly coupon that was 100 basis points per annum, which would then be directed to pay the coupon on the notes. So there was no requirement to source the reference portfolio in the underlying.
But when Goldman was writing its CDS, on the asset side. It was to a credit event, to, you know, non-payment. So there's no sort of tranching there. It's just
right. I think if I may, because I have the background that I think you're bringing to this. In the traditional,
but I do think, and it's not just for me, because I do think that this is part of the disconnect of people not understanding the long and short.
Yeah, there are two kinds of.
Relates to your question.
There are two kinds of synthetic CDOs, both of which occurred at Goldman Sachs as well as at most other places on the street. There was a synthetic CDO where you would take credit default swaps referencing each item of the portfolio and put them into the SPV. And that would be a full capital structure transaction. And then the cash flows coming from those credit default swaps would go down a waterfall just like any other securitization. So that would be referred to either as the fully synthetic waterfall CDO, or it could be a hybrid CDO where you may have some cash and some synthetics. That's variant one. Variant two, which would be transactions such as Abacus, which were referred to as partial capital structure transactions, where they went by different names. Morgan Stanley called theirs AB Spoke. Deutsche Bank called theirs Syrah or Ixion. Paribas called theirs Mermaid. Merrill called them Steers. Credit Suisse called them Magnolia. I mean, they're all out there. The transaction would be, again, rather than putting the entire portfolio, you would just have the specific tranche that would be issued. And
but that's on the liabilities.
Yes, the assets and liabilities directly match. And this is really one of the reasons for correlation trading, was that it allowed you to do bespoke trades. Because if you think of how to address IKB's issue, as I phrased it before, if IKB wanted a portfolio that looked like this, the probability that other customers may want the exact same transaction would be low. So the idea of doing these types of transactions is that every note can be customized to that investor's preferences, which means that if IKB does one transaction, we could show a similar transaction to another customer, and they may say, that's very interesting. However, I don't like some of the portfolio items. I would do a slightly different transaction where we take out other items of the portfolio, and we could print that transaction as well. Now, again, those two things may not be identical, but all of these credit default swaps were aggregated in our trading book and were managed in the aggregate. And this, as I was trying to describe earlier,
all of the on the short side.
And on the long side, since we also
managed it as you chose.
But we also wrote tranche protection to a variety of customers, although that wasn't as common a format until 2006. For instance, the AC1 transaction, we hedged by selling credit protection in tranche form to Paulson. Okay, but a trade such as the early IKB trades, once there was liquidity that was available in the credit default swap market for mortgages and asset backs, you would hedge by selling protection in a ratio. You wouldn't get long the whole $2 billion portfolio, since you would be significantly long, but you would hedge in a ratio. And the reason it was referred to as correlation trading is because you had a quantitative model, which was really just for marking to market. That also means that you didn't actually know what the right correlation was, but you would calibrate it to market prices, where you would say, we're going to purchase $100 million of credit protection, and if it was a lever tranche, depending on what it was, you would potentially hedge by selling $200 million, $300 million, for example, of the reference portfolio in a pro rata form. But this was based on this was referred to as delta hedging in the nomenclature. And this was something that we did as the market for credit default swaps developed in 2005.
So allow me to try to translate just so we can move forward and correct any mistakes. The reason in the Abacus transaction that Chris was asking about that the credit-linked note cash amount was less than the full tranche, as you wanted to preserve the ability to issue more if you found additional investors. Is that correct?
No, I wouldn't agree with that necessarily. It could be true in a specific instance, but I don't think it's generally true.
Another reason then could be that they were investing on a levered basis, so they were putting in cash a certain amount but taking exposure of a larger amount.
I wouldn't agree with that either. I mean, even in the Abacus 2005-07 transaction, the customers invested the $130 million. That was still their maximum exposure, right? They couldn't lose more than they put in unless they chose to put in more. That's the question. So,
right, and where the opposite of that, or where they could lose more, was, for example, the Timberwolf CDO, where the company that just sued you guys, you know, bought their long exposure by buying CDS, where their exposure was much beyond the $11 million that they paid.
No, again, their exposure in the CDS. As I understand, I'm not really familiar with those trades.
Okay. Then forget it if you're not familiar with it. Let me ask you this. This is a listing that that Gold Group produced to us. First page shows what I believe are those are the cash investments you're talking about in the Abacus 2004-1
yes.
deal, right?
That's correct.
And it shows IKB there for $100 million on three different tranches, I think. A, B, and C, if I'm remembering correctly. Right?
That's right.
Okay.
And
so,
yes, and I think that I misspoke earlier with respect. I don't think maybe there was not a, there was. I think they said there were four classes. It looks like there were three.
Okay, right. And I'm concerned about that. So my understanding from what you're saying is when IKB makes that $100 million cash investment, Goldman is taking a short position at the time of $100 million and paying the CDS premium income into the SPV, right?
In the first instance, yes. We had a short position as a result of being the protection buyer on the $100 million.
Okay. Turn to the very last page of that document. That is a listing that Goldman produced showing the CDS on this deal. I don't see $100 million by Goldman in 04.
Well, these are.
So help me.
I can interpret this. My understanding of what these exhibits are in response to is that this is showing CDS that were not pertaining to the issuance of notes. So what that would mean is that for every one of these notes, and really to be precise, you'd have to aggregate it by deal and class, since if three people bought notes referencing the Class A, there would only be one CDS on the Class A.
Okay. So
these swaps are distinct tranches from these notes, but there would also be CDS pertaining to the Class A notes, the Class B notes, and the Class C notes.
Okay. So help me, and I'm sorry.
And the counterparty would be the SPV, be Goldman facing SPV,
right.
Would be the CDS on these notes. These are trades where Goldman, where Goldman is protection buyer versus these customers.
Hey, Chris,
okay.
That last page is people who go long the transaction in swap form instead of note form.
Right.
Okay. So Goldman would be on the other side of the page. Before that, these are people, including you can see the Paulson funds down mm-hmm. there, who go short the transaction in swap. In swap form. So they would be Goldman's the initial swap protection provider. It then goes to, you know, okay. Magnetar.
So we don't have a listing then of Goldman's short position against the SPV for the cash transactions.
There's
right.
one, as he would point out, there's one for every one of those notes.
Yeah, there
how do we know that from that listing?
Yeah.
My main goal is to just understand these transactions.
We just want to know the total amount at risk in all these transactions. That's all we're trying to get to.
I think you now have it, but not on that.
Right.
That
then we don't have
that
it.
That document.
No, that's not from Monday. Is it?
Remember, this document we produced for
PSI.
Was it PSI or the SEC? I don't know. For somebody PSI. In this adventure. And these are all the notes. Okay, the first number of pages. Next to the last page is people who go short the portfolio on the other side of Goldman. And the last page is people who go long the transaction in swap form.
Right.
Because their request was investors in the notes, then investors who bought protection, investors who sold protection.
Now, separately, in response to your request, we provided all the credit default swaps as against the SPV. And that would be the ones that
oh, wait, that's the big
side.
Long sheet.
Yes.
Versus,
yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Because that's not just Abacus. It's also, you know, the full capital structure was as well.
You know.
We got that Monday. Yeah. Okay.
So good. So
that's good. Just trying to be clear.
And
it's been a long process.
So then, tell me if this is correct. For every cash note purchased long investment by like the IKB and all those numbers on that chart there, Goldman's on the other side in terms of CDS taking a short position. Yes.
Yes. Goldman would be the protection buyer on a tranche credit default swap corresponding to each of the notes issued.
Right. Okay. And then am I also right in hearing you correctly that as that protection buyer, they are paying premium income into the SPV, which is used to pay the LIBOR plus whatever on those cash notes?
Yeah. The LIBOR flat component would come off of the collateral securities.
Right, that the $100 million in this example are used to purchase.
And the spread over LIBOR, the 100 would come from the CDS. Again, to be very precise, I want to be precise, there was these other hedging derivatives called the basis swap, which was just we received the interest on the notes, the interest on the collateral and pay in LIBOR flat. And there was also a put fee, which was 6 basis points in these transactions, because we were writing a put. So the credit default swap would actually be for the stated spread of the note plus 6 basis points, to be precise.
Okay. Thank you. I think I understand it a little better now. So, again, turn to that last page, and I'll ask a couple questions, and then I'll have you go back and sort of explain creation of the deal. Go ahead.
I just want to make one correction, since I am going to be precise. For those transactions that involved a fee to be paid to a portfolio advisor or portfolio selection agent, the spread on the notes would be the credit default swap spread would be the spread on the notes plus 6 plus whatever the fee was pertaining to that class of notes. Just to make sure I'm not making any misstatements.
Sure.
Sorry.
So I think what that last page shows is like a $1.76 billion CDS from AIG like a year later, I think. Right?
That is correct. Right. May 26th.
So tell me what you know about that and what I mean in terms of is that AIG coming and saying, hey, I want to invest in an Abacus 2004-1, or is it Goldman going to AIG and saying, hey, I want to buy CDS from you guys on our unfunded super senior tranche?
With respect to these trades, we approached AIG. And the reason for that, I don't know if you're familiar with the what happened in the corporate markets in 2005 with the downgrade of Ford and GM. But it actually pertains to this. So,
let me interrupt you for a second. And if it also pertains to this, the fact that I think AIG was downgraded in March of 2005.
I recall that.
But when Greenberg left and all that stuff was going on.
Yeah, I don't think that's
okay.
Relevant.
You.
But yeah, I recall that as you mentioned it. The AIG Financial Products was a large participant in the market for super senior ABS CDOs, to my recollection, going back to 2001. And the first transaction I recall that they did was in November of that year with Goldman. But AIG wasn't doing credit default swap trades in CDS format. At that time, they were doing it by writing puts on the CDOs, which made those notes money market eligible, so that the notes would then be sold to money market funds, 2A7 eligible. And I believe they did transactions with Wachovia, Bear Stearns, Deutsche Bank are some of the names I recall, Morgan Stanley as well, in this format. So they were already, I was already aware, going back to 2001, that AIG had a business of investing in a synthetic format in credit defaults, not in credit defaults, but in super senior portfolios of asset-backed securities and mortgage-backed securities. We're also aware that AIGFP was writing super senior protection on corporate synthetic CDOs during this time period. What was occurring in 2005 was a dislocation in the credit markets owing to the downgrade to junk of GM and Ford, which was causing significant market volatility in the credit markets. And based on hearsay and market chatter, creating significant losses in correlation books in the corporate space as a result of these very large and volatile market moves. So we, at the time, had done, we had done three Abacus transactions in 2004, as well as one other in 2005. I don't recall if we had done the second trade in 2005. At the time of these super senior swaps, we may have. But we observed what was happening in the correlation market for corporates and recognized that, and not only did I recognize, but the management of the mortgage department recognized that there was correlation risk in, by virtue of not having purchased super senior protection on these portfolios. So we had a requirement before proceeding with future Abacus transactions to substantially, what's referred to as complete capital structure, means to buy tranche protection on the layers of the reference portfolio that we had not previously purchased protection by virtue of the Abacus notes, for instance, that we described earlier. So in the case of the 041 transaction, we had sold some notes at IKB, we checked the dates here, and we had sold some notes in, looks like, January and March of 2005 to Wachovia and TCW. But we had not purchased any protection on the junior layer below the IKB notes, nor had we purchased any super senior protection on the layer above the notes. So we approached AIG through our sales coverage and inquired as to their interest in looking at super senior tranched portfolios representing referencing mortgage and ABS securities.
Okay. So let me stop you for a minute because you're starting to lose me. I understand when the initial deal is done for $100 million and Goldman takes the short position for $100 million. When Wachovia and TCW come in and buy another $95 million, does Goldman do another $95 million short position?
We would buy $95 million of additional tranche protection.
Okay.
For getting to those layers.
So where I'm lost then, where hopefully you can help me, is with the other tranches not funded, I'm not understanding the correlation risk you're talking about and the need to buy protection on unfunded tranches.
Well, the correlation risk arises because if you write protection, as I described earlier, you have to write protection on a ratio of the reference portfolio in order to hedge the short position.
Okay.
So I'm going to make hypothetical numbers, but I think they're illustrative. If you purchased $100 million of tranche protection, and again, the sum of the parts has to add up to the whole. So if the reference portfolio is $2 billion, then the sum of the riskiness, if you will, the mark, and I'm talking about mark-to-market riskiness, not exclusively the credit riskiness, the sum of the parts, so the super senior plus the tranches that have been sold to IKB and others plus the first loss, that has to add up to the $2 billion, the whole. So correlation models were one mechanism by which you could attempt to quantify and say, well, you've got these three distinct layers, the first loss, the mezz, and the senior. And how do you divide that up, the riskiness of the $2 billion up between those three distinct layers? Now, the problem is if you write $300 million of protection, you can see why, hopefully, the way I've laid it out, why the mezzanine layer, the IKB layer, is riskier than the notional because it's levered, it's got a big senior layer on top of it. So the $1.76 billion notional super senior tranche trade, from a mark-to-market perspective, would be less risky than $1.76 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, the first loss, the riskiest layer, may only be, you know, I'll make up a number, $50 million thick, but it could be equivalent to $400 million, again, to make up the number, of mark-to-market risk. Because, again, the sum of the parts has to add up to $2
billion. Mm-hmm.
So the problem is if you've hedged your $100 million of tranche protection with $300 million of longs, that would maybe be the correct hedge for assuming your correlation is correct and assuming that the market moves are not large. But if you have a sudden huge shock to the market, you'd be long $300 million. Ultimately, you know, if everything got wiped out, you'd lose $200 million.
Mm-hmm.
You see this, the map?
Yeah.
So the buying super senior protection and then hedging that actually results to mitigate your correlation risk. The more you complete capital structure, the more you've identified how the sum of the parts have to add up. And in the simplest case, when you complete everything, now you're just short $2 billion, and then you can be long $2 billion, and then you're done. You have no more correlation risk. You don't have to worry about modeling and thinking about, you know, what are the quantitative risk measures.
Okay.
So the imperative that was given to us was complete capital structure. Make sure you know where these layers trade. Because it's not only a question of how much trading do you do, it's also do you know where the layers trade in the market. Because if you don't know where the layers trade in the market, you don't know if your model is properly calibrated to the market prices.
Okay. So I think I understood most of that. So the other day we were talking to Mr. Cohn, I believe, and in fact I do know we were talking to Mr. Cohn. I believe he said that you guys, in terms of your credit default swap relationship with AIG, ran a matched book. And what I'm getting at is trying to continue to use the 2004 one as an example, is if you're buying $1.76 billion of protection from AIG for 12 basis points, I think it's in there. Who's on the other side of that trade?
Well, I don't know the context of your discussion.
Yeah, am I missing something?
He was talking about so-called negative basis trades, which were a portion, fair portion, of the total number of these.
About 75%.
Truck swaps with AIG, where there was definitely somebody on the other side that was matched. That's not Jonathan's.
Yeah.
Jonathan's the rest.
Yeah, the total, you can see we did 7 super senior swap trades with AIG.
Right.
It looks like, as I recall, the aggregate notional originally was somewhere between $5 and $6 billion if you sum up the original notional amounts of the trades.
Okay. You're just talking about the 7 Abacus deals there?
Yeah. And let me see if I've counted it up correctly, or if it may be a little bit more than 6. Those those trades out of the total of approximately 21 or 22 billion of total super senior trades, right? Was, so it's roughly 25% of the total trades. So I don't know. Again, if Mr. Cohen was speaking.
You're losing me when you say 20-25% of the total trades.
Yeah, the universe of trades. That again, I don't know what questions you asked, Mr. Cohen, but the universe of, you know, the point being these abacus trades were approximately 25% of the total population of super senior trades, credit default swap trades with AIG.
Right, I get that. I know there were other
correct
CDS purchases other than the abacus.
So these were not negative basis trades. These were trades that were done in the correlation book where we purchased protection and then we looked to hedge by writing credit protection on either the same instruments or related instruments to either customers or other trading desks in Goldman that were the market makers in the underlying.
Okay, and that wasn't your area?
My area was the buying of the tranche right. credit protection and then selling tranche or single name credit protection to other parties, whether internal or external. I was not the negative basis matched book.
Okay.
Business.
Okay. Thank you. Explain to me, generally, and we can continue to use this abacus deal as an example if you want, how you guys go about getting the ratings from the rating agencies.
Well, first, I don't actually recall that any of these super senior swaps were rated.
I mean the deal in general.
Okay. So, with respect to notes, the process was that the rating agencies, there were a few transactions where we used all three of Moody's, S&P, and Fitch. In the majority that I recall, it was Moody's and S&P, and some others it was S&P, Fitch, or I think there was a couple that were like that. The process would be to send to the rating agency a description of the portfolio, including the line items, as well as the term sheet on the transaction, and as the documentation of the transaction was developed. But I don't mean the offer circle, I mean the governing documents of the transaction. And then they would issue a rating letter at or around the closing date of the transaction.
The first document you mentioned, the line by line or line item thing?
Well, they would receive a spreadsheet listing the portfolio.
Okay. Meaning the reference clause.
The reference portfolio.
Okay.
Yes.
And then, the information submitted and they say, here it is?
There were two different types of analysis that rating agencies did that I recall.
Okay.
One was the quantitative analysis of the reference portfolio, and the other analysis was of documentation. So,
explain to me the quantitative analysis, and then
sure.
Explain to me the other.
The quantitative analysis, and again, I'm speaking over the entirety of the time period. I don't know if there's a particular time period you wanted me to focus on.
No.
The rating agencies each made available to investors as well as dealers their quantitative software that you would put the portfolio into the software and it would generate for that portfolio what the relevant ratings were. So that was really the quantitative analysis of the portfolio that I recall. It was really, to my experience, pretty straightforward.
So do they, I'm going to demonstrate my ignorance here, but I see, when I look at an offering circular, right, you see where the various tranches are and what the dollar amount are. Do the rating agencies, when they get done with the quant analysis, say, here's where the various attachment points need to be for the various tranches, and to get, if you want a AAA rating on this, well then, 48% of the deal has to be less than it, that's where the attachment point has to be?
It varied a little bit by the specifics of the rating agency. I mean, I think that's essentially correct, but I want to be precise. Some portion of the abacus transaction, let's say, you know, somewhere in the vicinity of 50% of the notional amount were commercial real estate related, say predominantly CMBS underwriters. For those transactions, you would send a spreadsheet with the portfolio to the rating analyst, and they would come back to you with a spreadsheet saying, here's the amount to AAA, AA, et cetera. So they would just respond to you with what, after they ran it themselves. For the transactions that were more ABS related, so that had more mortgage RMBS related or consumer ABS related, you would use the software they provided to you, where again you would put in the reference portfolio. You would, in the case of S&P and Fitch, you would press some button that kicked off some proprietary algorithm that was embedded in their software that wasn't available to us. It would come back with a list saying AAA, you need, for example, 48, AA, et cetera. It would just spit out an answer. For the case of Moody's, because of their methodology, you would put in the portfolio as well as you would say, my class sizes look like this. So my AAA is the 20 to 30 layer. And you hit the button, and it would tell you the rating of that thing, 20 to 30, is AAA, or it's AA, or single A, or whatever.
Were there times... did you personally deal with the rating agencies?
Yes, on a number of occasions I did.
Okay, are there other people in terms of the abacus deals anyway that are dealing with the rating agencies, or is that your fund responsibility?
No, I mean, each person on the team interacted in certain ways. I mean, we had, for some period of this time, we had a person from the structuring group, which was not part of our trading desk, a man named Shinkawa, who was part of that separate group within the mortgage department who was assigned to help us with structuring tasks. So many of his responsibilities included the day-to-day running of these kinds of analyses and receiving feedback from the rating agencies. And then in addition to myself, people who were on the actual trading desk, Mr. Tor, Mr. Gerst, and then for a period of time, Mr. Williams, as well. So we also had some junior analysts on the desk that, you know, may have had interaction with the rating agencies, I don't know.
Generally, was there a back and forth, for example? I mean, were there times the rating agencies would come back and say, okay, you know, to get these tranches rated AAA, you know, the attachment point's got to be at 48%. You guys would say, it's too high. It should really be lower. I mean, was there that back and forth kind of stuff?
On the quantitative portfolio modeling side of it?
I don't know if those discussions occur on the quant side or on the other side that we're talking about, whatever side in terms of getting the deal rated.
Well, I can talk about the document side in a second, because there I think the answer is different. On the quantitative side, the software was available to us, and so if the portfolio was what it was and the software was what it was, I don't recall that there were disagreements about the use of the software.
So then explain to me the other side.
Now, on the criteria side, as I mentioned, the rating agencies had published their criteria with respect to synthetic CDOs generally, not only transactions like Abacus, but also hybrid CDOs, full cash CDOs. They had a large document that was available to the general public on their website. Now, the rating agencies, these criteria were not prescriptive. They didn't say, you know, the language must look exactly like this. They say, you know, our policy is that, you know, to have AAA, the rating of a counterparty should fall into certain bands. I'm using a hypothetical example. So the criteria, the transaction documents would be sent to them, and on occasion, as they changed their criteria, they would come back and say, you know, we think this portion of the document needs to be revised. So as an example, at some point, I recall in 2006, S&P informed us that the number of collateral securities, at least AAA collateral securities in the abacus transaction, should be capped at 15. Previously, they had not specified that. So they informed us of that. and we said why, and they explained to us that they wanted to they had changed their criteria to limit the maximum number because they were concerned that if there was a very small collateral security, that one collateral security defaulted, that it made their criteria they felt made their criteria less robust. So we accepted that comment. So we amended that, and then we used that criteria going forward.
Okay, so then on the documentation side, again, and if you can talk in terms of an example, great, but I'm just trying to understand, you know, like I said, when I look at an offering circular, you know, you can see the various tranches, and you can see the, you know, the AAA rated A1 notes, and the, you know, you've got the A2 and the B2 and the, and the equity tranche.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to understand the back and forth on how those tranches get done.
And
with the interaction and with the rating agencies on that, other than just the straight, once the documentation is done, we feed it in the model and it spits it out.
Well, again, my recollection of this was there was not a lot of back and forth on the what is the attachment point. The document, I mean, we spent a little, you know, with the earliest Abacus transactions, which was, you know, the market was much less mature. There was not a standardized credit default swap documentation. There was, you know, discussion with the rating agencies about, you know, just how would the mechanics of the transactions work. But by the time, you know, we were doing transactions in late 2005, there was already a standard for credit default swaps for mortgages and asset-backed securities. I don't recall that there was a lot of back and forth. And particularly your question is respect to the credit enhancement. So how much to get to AAA? I don't recall that there was a lot of debate with the software. You ran the software,
mm-hmm.
right? Now the I just don't.
Okay. Explain to me if you can how correlation amongst, you know, the various types of assets and the reference, you know, collateral impact rating.
I don't really know with respect to how they rated it, since I wasn't privy to their models or algorithms.
Was it something that impacted the rating, though? Do you know? I mean, if you've got all, if the reference collateral is all, you know, RMBS backed by subprime loans and stocks in California and nowhere else, versus, you know, you've got credit cards and you've got student
yeah.
loans and you've got loans and you've got mortgage loans all over the country. You know, how does that impact, you know, well, I know how it impacts correlation, but then how does it impact the rating because of that, if you know generally?
But I do know from reading their general description of their software that they described that it was running simulations that included correlation. So I did see that word appear in their documentation, but as to what the correlation parameters were, I don't know.
Once Abacus deals were done and the cash investments are made and then the CDS is done, do you continue to have involvement in those deals?
Well, we do from the perspective of being a derivative counterparty. So our involvement as a counterparty would proceed for the life of the transaction, which we would have open risk to the transaction for the entirety of its legal life.
So, for example, on, you know, there's seven Abacus trades with AIG, and there was some collateral disputes with AIG on those CDS. Were you involved in those discussions?
My recollection is that there actually were not collateral disputes on the Abacus trades with AIG. My recollection is that there was a period of time in 2007 when AIG was not posting any collateral in respect to a kind of a margin call.
Right.
But that there was technically, I guess, a dispute for that period of time. But that after some discussions where there was at least partial posting of collateral, that the allocation of collateral attributed to Abacus trades, what we were calling margin, that they were posting the allocated amount that we were specifying. So to be precise, I don't recall that in those periods where AIG posted that where we were calling collateral on Abacus, that they were paying that amount.
Okay.
So I don't believe
there may have been disputes on other credit defaults, but not on the abacus credit defaults.
That's my recollection, yes.
Okay. That's helpful. I don't have the documents with me, but we've seen documents that Goldman has produced that show, for example, Goldman is essentially laying off some of its short position shortly before marks are made that require the long investor of the CDS to make payments. Was that do you know of any practice at Goldman where, hey, we're the only entity on the short side here, we need to lay off some short side when we make this mark, we can say it's not just us?
I'm not familiar with that.
Did you follow that? I know it wasn't the most articulate in the world.
I didn't really understand it.
Okay.
I'm not familiar with it.
Say, for example, and I don't know that this happened on the Abacus deal, but since we're talking about that one, the $1.76 billion short position with AIG, right? And so say it's, it's getting to be, I know on AIG the first Goldman call was July 26, 2007. I don't know if it was had anything to do with Abacus. But let's say, in May or June, Goldman says, hey, we're going to do a mark. It's going to result in us making a call on FP. We have more. It's easier us to make that call and try to get the money from AIG if we tell them it's not just us on the short side, but we have folks on, that are also part of this deal. That's just generally not for Abacus. For Abacus, those are you dealing with. That kind of circumstance ever happened to your knowledge?
No.
Okay. I know from looking at the documents that it looks like Goldman, I think the last Abacus trade maybe have been the Paulson trade. What is that your recollection? Maybe be on that.
The last, I believe it was 2007.
The 2017-18.
The credit default swap for AC1 was, I believe, in May of 07.
Right. So that's 2007-18. I think that's a listing that either you guys produced or we created from something you produced. Do you know?
We created it from something they produced.
This is
but that's the
okay.
May.
No, it's not actually.
The May. You're talking the May 17th.
Right, and all I'm getting at, that's really just to say, apparently that's when the last one was done. And all I'm getting at is why. Did you guys stop doing Abacus deals? Was it simply no more client demand, or?
Well, this transaction was a CMBS related transaction, just by coincidence. We did transactions after this that were not Abacus transactions. So we were making markets. In these instruments after this. So you're referring to primary issuances of Abacus transactions?
Yeah, this is just the last deal we see in terms of where there's an offering circular.
Well, the markets. Yeah, my recollection was that the market was becoming extremely dislocated shortly after this point.
Okay. Is that another way of saying there simply wasn't client demand for these investments anymore?
No, I wouldn't say that because there were secondary purchases or sales of unsold allotments that occurred in these instruments after this time period.
Okay.
That's my recollection.
Sure. And for all I know, in that other listing I gave you, maybe there's cash purchases on there after May of 07. I don't know off the top of my head.
Now, just so that we're clear, the other sheet has the sales of notes, and it's got this. It's got the swaps that are kind of tied to the issuances, if you will. And then you guys said, when we said contemplated, that's what we meant by that. We said, no, we think that's a little, we don't understand what that means, give us everything. And so with the production on Monday, you have a lot more
credit default swaps that reference those portfolios, what happened later.
Right. One thing I would add is
sort of secondary trading in that.
Right. The, as noted in this schedule, the credit default swap on the AC1 transaction was May 31st of 07.
Right.
Which
right.
would be subsequent to this particular
right.
schedule.
I guess you say, you know, as far as new issues,
sorry. I know this is unusual.
Was that the last one you guys brought to market?
I'm sorry.
I guess, Chris, your question was like in terms of those new issues, that was the 2007-18 was the last one you guys brought to market, or not
that
brought to market, but
that's correct.
Okay,
but I recall that we were still discussing transactions with people that didn't get consummated.
Okay, we certainly know about. Oh, strike that. Before the lawsuit gets filed on the policy deal, I guess we'll strike that. I guess since that Abacus AC1 policy deal, I take it you were involved in that deal?
I was aware of the deal, and I participated in some minor ways. I wasn't the primary person working on that transaction.
How did you participate in that deal?
I recall observing some of the email exchanges that were going on between the deal team and some of the various customers who were involved. I recall participating in some discussions involving who might be selection agents that Goldman could consider approaching. I recall reviewing certain sections of some of the documents.
Did you have any discussions with either anyone at Marx? Did you have any discussions with anyone at ACA?
I don't recall any discussions with anyone at ACA in the transaction.
Okay. Did you have discussions with other potential selection agents other than ACA?
I was aware that GSC...
Yes, that you had discussions.
Yeah, so I don't recall that I personally had discussions.
Okay, you were aware that GSC...
I was aware that another asset manager had been approached.
Mm-hmm. And who chooses the selection manager, I guess, would be a good place to start here.
So you're referring to this transaction?
Yes.
I don't know.
Okay. Generally, is it Goldman?
Well, I think it depends, is the answer.
Okay. What does it depend on?
Well, I can give you an example. The... at this time, same time period, one of the transactions I was very focused on, I should say transaction idea I was focused on, which also involved IKB, was what we referred to as the managed Abacus program. And the idea behind that was for, you know, IKB was continuing to do bespoke transaction ideas, but they wanted to also do managed transactions in synthetic format. In our program, and so I was informed by the salesperson that they were quite keen on having these discussions, and so we received from them their approval and consent to approach Putnam and PIMCO, two large U.S. money managers, to discuss managing Abacus transactions that would involve not only portfolio selection, but ongoing management, where IKB would be a large investor in at least 100 million of notes in each of these managed transactions. So that would be an example of a situation where I would say, although those transactions did not occur because of market events, where IKB was effectively selecting the portfolio manager.
Okay. Did IKB select the portfolio manager in the AC1 deal?
I don't know who selected the portfolio manager, the selection agent, to be precise in that field.
You had mentioned GSC was, you know, GSC was not the selection agent or whatever the proper nomenclature is for the AC1 deal. Do you know why that is?
I recall being informed by Mr. Tor that they had declined.
Did he say why they declined?
I recall that the reason he relayed was that they were GSC was at the time not comfortable with more than a small fraction of the 2006 vintage subprime transaction universe.
Okay, so in this encore, is that's the reference collateral we're talking about, right?
They said it as I recall was relayed to me that it didn't specify ratings. It just said 2006 vintage subprime. So I didn't know more than that.
Sorry, I didn't say ratings. I said he's talking about the reference collateral for the deal.
Chris,
I don't know that we talk past each other.
Trouble, yeah, with Jonathan is bothering me. You keep saying reference collateral, mm-hmm. and the reference portfolio and the collateral are two different things.
Okay, then let's make sure we're not talking about it. My understanding of the AC1 deal, anyway, is that there were 90 bonds that were the reference collateral, right? That depended on how the deal shook out.
The 90 bonds that I recall would have been, I think, termed the reference portfolio. Okay.
Explain to me what the difference is here between the reference portfolio and the reference collateral.
Well, I think that, as Frank was saying, the two distinct terms are the, in general, not specific to any, you know, that abacus transaction. The reference portfolio would be the synthetics on which the credit default swaps were referenced. The collateral would be AAA asset-backed securities. That would be the collateral is sitting inside the deal to fund credit protection payments to Goldman.
Okay,
which relates to the credit.
Right. Okay. So, and I'm sure I'll say it the wrong way now when I want to refer to again, in the AC1 deal.
Reference assets.
Thank you.
Is that better?
The ACA selected the reference assets, correct?
Yes, I believe they did.
Okay. And now, again, you said that you heard from Mr. Tor that GSC decided to be the selector of the reference assets. That's the right term. I'm already forgetting. And again, tell me again why he told you they declined.
Well, I recall it was in an email that was sent to a distribution group, mm-hmm. that GSC was declining to serve as the portfolio selection agent because they were not comfortable with more than some unspecified portion, small portion, of subprime RMBS from the 2006 vintage.
Okay. Did ACA, if you know, have similar concerns?
I didn't have any communication with ACA on this transaction.
Okay. Did these before the lawsuit by the SEC, actually strike that, did either ACA or IKB ever contact you to complain about the performance of the deal after the deal's done and they take their losses?
Sorry, IKB and who else?
ACA, the other cash long investor in the deal.
No, I don't recall receiving any complaints.
Okay. Did you have any dealings with the folks at Paulson on the AC1 deal?
I recall one telephone conversation that I had that the salesperson was ringing up Fabrice's line, but I picked up the line because he was away.
Is that Mr. Pellegrin?
Yes, I recall that the Goldman salesperson and Mr. Pellegrini were on. I don't know if the other Paulson people were on.
And what's the nature of that conversation? Just Tor's not here. I picked up his phone. I'll have him call you.
I picked up. The salesperson informed me that Paulson wished to relay feedback. When I say Paulson, I mean the individuals from the Paulson Fund. Wished to relay feedback on an economic proposal that Mr. Tor had made to them. So he asked me if I was willing to receive that feedback and relay it to the group. So I did.
Did you have any discussions with anybody from IKB on the AC1 deal?
No, I don't recall any.
Okay. And I know I probably asked this, but did you have any discussions with folks at ACA?
I don't recall any.
Okay. And just the one conversation with the folks at Paulson.
That's what I recall.
Did TOR report to you? Is that just in terms of reporting structure?
Well, I wasn't the formal supervisor on the trading desk at the time.
What about just in terms of the abacus deals? I mean, are you the guy in charge of the abacus? I mean, what I'm getting at is you're telling me you didn't have many conversations with at least the investors in the abacus deal. But are you in charge of that deal? I mean, do TOR and other, if there are other salesmen on that deal, you know, report to you for on a deal by deal basis?
Well, first off, I mean, TOR was not a salesperson; he was a trader. I think the answer is the same. And the abacus products were a component of our correlation trading. I wasn't the formal supervisor.
Okay.
On the correlation trading desk.
Okay. So, I mean, I'm sure you generally know the allegations in the SEC's lawsuit, but I mean, did you ever hear that ACA did in fact know that Paulson was going to short the deal?
I don't recall any conversations about what ACA knew.
Okay. What about did anybody, I don't mean with ACA, I just mean with anybody within Goldman or otherwise, did you ever hear or receive an email from anyone that says, hey, you know, ACA does know that Paulson's going to short the deal?
I don't recall that coming up.
Same question for the folks at IKP.
No, I don't recall hearing about what IKP knew or didn't know.
Okay. I mean, there's an allegation in the complaint that IKP not only didn't, I think there's an allegation in the complaint that not only didn't IKP know about Paulson shorting the deal, but they didn't know that Paulson, you know, had a role in selecting the reference assets. Did you ever hear anything about that from anybody when the deal was being done?
I don't recall any.
Was there someone between you and Mr. TOR that was supervising the transaction?
No, Mr. TOR was the vice president in charge of the transaction. Okay.
Were there other people involved in that deal besides Mr. TOR? And your limited involvement, it sounds like.
Well, my recollection.
No, I don't want to interfere with your examination. You know, we're here to help you, but it seems to me we're now focusing on a matter that's in litigation as opposed to the causes of the financial crisis. So it's fine to do a limited amount of this, but I don't think we ought to be conducting a...
I appreciate that, but if you looked at our statute, you would also see that one of the things we're supposed to look at is the role of potential fraud in the financial crisis. So it's certainly relevant, certainly something that we should be asking about, and we'd be remiss if we didn't. I appreciate that. I don't plan to spend a lot of time on it, but there's certain questions that I feel I have to ask.
Okay.
So...
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
I can if I
remember. Who else worked on the deal?
That was your goal, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Who else? It worked. yeah, who else worked on the deal besides your limited involvement and Mr. TOR?
My recollection is that you know, Mr. TOR and Mr. Gerst, from the email traffic that I was observing, seemed to be having the majority of the work on the transaction.
Who sold it? That you said Mr. Turr wasn't a sales function, so who was a salesperson on that? Maybe I won't ask specifically about the deal, but how would you distribute these deals? Were they inbound calls, were they outbound calls, and who was involved in the distribution of the deals?
Well,
and then we'll go back to this.
My recollection on this transaction was that the notes were being shown out by syndicate, the Goldman Sachs syndicate desk.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I don't know if you know, how salespeople, you know, what they did with that information once they get sent it to various sales lists.
Was there a person at Syndicate you dealt
with? It was a team, so I don't know which individuals may have been involved in it, because it was Syndicate, and, you know, I don't know how they assigned their responsibilities for each deal.
It's been written in the press anyway. I don't know if it's in the SEC complaint that Paulson approached Goldman about putting together this deal. Believe it or not, I'm not going to ask you about that, but I'm going to ask you whether other investors. You had mentioned earlier that IKB approached you guys, and that was the genesis for the first Abacus deal in 2004. Did short investors approach you guys, and were they the genesis for any of the Abacus deals done?
You mean other than Paulson?
Yeah. Okay. So yes, but okay. So Paulson was the genesis for AC1, I take it.
My recollection was that Paulson, I testified to this. Mm-hmm. So my recollection was that Mr. Torrid formed the team and others that Paulson had approached him with interest in that. So. That's my recollection for the AC1 transaction. So your question is, were there other Abacus transactions where a... when you say Abacus transactions, are you referring specifically to credit link note transactions or swap transactions as well?
As well.
Because right, as I look on the schedule, on the last page, there's these transactions that say IMDX.
Mm-hmm.
My recollection is that Paulson... those involved the issuance of notes as securities. They involved some swaps.
Okay.
My recollection is those transactions also approached Goldman Sachs as well.
Okay. And what, I mean, you have the schedule in front of you. What Abacus deal is that?
Well, there was no Abacus deal. They're just swaps that are kind of colloquially referred to as INDX, Abacus versus INDX. But there were no actual notes placed in respect to those transactions.
Or were they related to, were they ABS swaps, or what are they?
They were, my recollection is, and I don't recall them in a lot of detail, but they were a granular portfolio of subprime RMBS.
Okay, so other than the INDX transaction that you're looking at in AC1, were there other Abacus deals, either type, you know, where the genesis was a short investor?
No, I don't recall any.
Okay, so meaning that for all the other deals, the genesis was a long investor approaching Goldman and looking for an investment.
I don't recall any transaction other than those where a short investor. Contact us. You're asking, sorry, you're saying everything else, did a long investor contact us? I'm just making sure I heard the question correctly.
Yeah, is that the case?
Well, I don't recall in every specific instance if the customer called Goldman first and the salesperson then called us, or if a team member called a salesperson and said, how do you feel about calling this customer and seeing if you're interested in doing a transaction? So I don't know. You know, the specific order, but I'm not, you know, I don't know if you differentiate between those cases. But.
So when Goldman does an Abacus deal, for example, the 2004 one deal, and the original $100 million cash notes are purchased, and then $95 million down the road from Alcovia and TCW, I think you said earlier that cash is used to buy AAA securities.
That was correct, yes.
Where are those AAA securities purchased from?
Those AAA securities were purchased from the market.
Were they purchased from Goldman's inventory ever?
Ever. Yes, in some cases.
Okay. And who decides what AAA securities are purchased?
It varies by deal. In each of the transactions, the initial collateral securities were listed in the offering circular.
Okay.
So they were just disclosed, these are what they are, that I recall. They were also described in the transaction documents, the rules by which if a given collateral security had paid some principal and there was no cash in the vehicle, it was permitted to pick new collateral securities. And the rules varied by deal. For some, and some of these terms were negotiated bilaterally. So for some of them, Goldman picked them, subject to the limitations. For others, Goldman picked them and investors had a veto. In others, Goldman either picked them or in some cases investors had a veto.
So it sounds like Goldman always picks them, and then either there's a veto power by investors or no veto power by investors.
I think that's the fair summary, yes.
And there's rules about Goldman yes. picking the securities anyway.
That's
so what happens in general? Go ahead.
So that would be the situation where on the list of CDOs, NA was marked under the collateral manager column?
No, I don't think that this.
You have to do this.
Yeah, this is
different. Right.
This is the collateral securities.
So, for example, in the Paulson deal where there was a collateral manager, Goldman still decided what AAA securities to buy with the $192 million, right?
Well, there wasn't a collateral manager for the AC1 deal. There was a portfolio selection agent. They're quite
you're
different.
Right. You're right. I'm sorry.
With that amendment.
Right.
But, okay, so generally, even when there is a collateral manager or a portfolio selection agent, it's still Goldman that when the cash comes in for the notes that decides which AAA securities are purchased, subject to rules and possibly subject to investor veto.
Yeah, I mean, I can only speak for the Abacus platform. I can't speak for how these things worked in the structured product CDOs. I wasn't familiar with the details. I think it's important to note that Goldman Sachs wrote a par put on every AAA collateral security that went into these Abacus transactions. So the risk was ultimately Goldman's.
And I think that just answered my next question. What happens if the value of those AAA securities that they purchase go down?
That would result in a mark-to-market loss to Goldman and potentially a realized loss if that collateral security needs to be liquidated to fund a credit event payment or a payment of principal to the note holders.
And that par put you mentioned, that meant Goldman would have to make good?
Yes.
Okay.
And we've lost a significant amount of money on the exercise of these puts against us over the years.
Were they always struck at par? They were
yes.
always struck at par.
They were always struck at
and
par.
And every Abacus deal
yes.
had them.
I apologize for confusing the collateral versus portfolio selection.
I'm sorry for not reaching you on the table push.
This isn't. So I have a different list that refers to collateral manager, but these terms of collateral manager versus asset manager could be confused. So. I think in this list, even though it asked for collateral manager, in your usage, it was really asset manager. And many of the Abacus deals are listed, and were, whether it was this document or other documents we received, is in the response. So were those Abacus deals static deals? Was there a selection agent? Or was Goldman Sachs putting forward the reference assets?
In the Abacus transactions, my recollection is we had the AC1 transaction that had a portfolio selection agent. And as if I just kind of list them, I think hopefully that will be the most direct way of answering your question. Portfolio selection agent, as was disclosed in that transaction, ACA selected the reference portfolio, mm-hmm. but after the closing date, the portfolio was static and the assets were just living out their natural life. But there was no ongoing involvement by ACA management. There were other transactions where I recall we used the term portfolio advisor, and there were three transactions. There were three, to speak very literally, there were four transactions in the materials I produced to you, because one of the transactions, which was the 06NS1, there were two SBVs. One was 06NS1, one was 06NS2. And those had the same portfolio, same structure, except that the NS2 notes were effectively the junior layer, and North Star Realty Finance purchased that, and the NS1 was the notes that were distributed to third-party investors. But they were identical with respect to portfolio, et cetera. It was just one was the bottom and one was the top. But so if I misspeak and say there's three, it's really four. If you make it, call it 3A, 3B, if you understand what I'm saying. So there was the North Star transaction, which was a CMBS transaction in 2006. There was the CBAS transaction 2005 CB1, which was in, I believe, November or December of 2005, where CBAS was the portfolio advisor, and that was a predominantly RMBS-related transaction. And then in 2006, there was the 2006 HGS1 transaction, where BSAM was portfolio advisor. So those transactions had a named party who could do, this is the distinction with the selection agent, they not only selected the portfolio, but they also had ongoing monitoring responsibilities and the right, but not the obligation, the right to remove credit impaired reference obligations if they thought that was in the interest of noteholders. So those are the transactions that I recall will have something other than NA in that column that you were referring to. Because the other transactions were predominantly, as I recall, negotiated bespoke transactions where Goldman and at least one sponsor investor negotiated the portfolio bilaterally with Goldman.
Let me ask you, it may be an elementary question, but it's one of those. So, I guess I'm going to try to get the questions of profitability, like how profitable, Abacus transactions were. And so, how did you look at that out on the desk? Like, how did you determine the profitability of a transaction once it was closed and going forward, since you had?
Well, it's a very good question. It's also, unfortunately, a hard question.
Yeah, I know that. I've asked it for a couple of people. I keep trying to ask it. Hopefully, I'll get it one of these times.
Let me attempt to address it directly this way. As I mentioned, the Abacus transactions were a component of our market-making activities in the structural product correlation desk. So whether it was notes issued or swaps, protection bought and sold, these were all trades that rolled into a trading book that looked at all these risks together. So every swap, whether it was related to a note issuance or a direct swap where we were facing a swap counterparty, that swap would exist in our book and have an NPV or a dollar value associated with it, whether gain or loss. And that was a function of, they would say, well, it would, our trade booking systems would obviously record the key information on the trade, the date, the termination date, i.e., like how long would this trade be alive, which would typically be 30, 40 years for these long-lived instruments, what the upfront payment was, what the ongoing CDS premium was, all these other, obviously what the trade was, what thing it was referencing. And these correlation valuation models would each night mark these trades to market based upon the inputs to the model, which would be our trading desk, the ABS trading desk, the CMBS trading desk, etc., would each night mark the underlying obligations, the reference assets, to use your term. And then these models, which were developed by our quant groups, would value these swaps using these models. So it's important to note that I was a price taker with respect to the price of the underlying instruments. So if RMBS were if the RMBS desk said RMBS prices dropped by a point today, they would input that. That would flow through into my P&L overnight. The model would chug through all the trades and put out new MPVs. Right, so the only thing I really could make the pricing view on was how to price the correlation risk for a given tranche. Okay, so I just want to put that in some perspective. So we would have a model that would spit out every night for every trade what we think the MPV was on the prior day based on the prior day's closing price. So our hedges would also get marked to market. So we did hedges in index form. We did hedges in single name credit default swap form. We did a few hedges in total rate of return swap form. We also had certain cash instruments that we were long. We also, to make it even more complex, had this put risk that I described a moment ago, which was de minimis with respect to our P&L until the end of 2007. So I'm going to kind of conveniently ignore it, although it became very significant as we got to the end of 2007 and thereafter. So we also have P&L models crunching through what this put could potentially cost us. So I'm going to focus on the simpler stuff first. So the simple answer is we would track every day what the MPV was on a given swap in our books. That did not necessarily give us a very easy holistic view to say on the CBAS trade, 05CB1, how much did we make? Right? Because it was very hard to line up all the protection buys and all the protection sells unless they literally happened on the same date at the same time.
But you had a fee for structuring the deal?
That's important.
It was all a spread?
We did not earn fee business in the Abacus program. We bought protection, and if we were able to resell protection at a higher price in aggregate, then we would record P&L. Now, it just so happens that some trades are easier to analyze than others because of their relative structures.
I think there's an allegation in the SEC suit that there was a $15 million fee paid by Paulson for you guys structuring that deal.
Right, and that happens to be one of the trades which this you can analyze, and I don't agree personally with that characterization.
If they said fee, they're wrong.
Okay, yeah, so I don't agree with the characterization of the fee because protection, as my recollection, was purchased and credit protection was sold at a markup.
So is it your understanding that the fee, as the SEC terms it, is simply the CDS premium that Paulson paid?
My recollection was that there was not only an ongoing premium, but an upfront payment as well. Right? Credit default swaps typically have, as part of their economic terms that I mentioned earlier, either an upfront as well as an ongoing.
Okay.
My recollection is that we estimated that our trading revenues in connection with the AC1 transaction were approximately $15 million.
And was that an NPV number? The upfront payment plus the periodic payments?
Yeah, I recall that was an estimate of the difference between the NPV of the protection buys versus the NPV of the protection sells.
Okay. So what Paulson actually paid, obviously, is more than that.
I would have to go back and check. I'm not sure I recall exactly what the ongoing premiums were. Depending on what the ongoing premiums were, they may have netted out. I don't know.
But my only point, just to make sure I get it, is the 15 mil is a number that is a net present value number.
That's my recollection.
Okay. It's not an actual, here's the cash.
I'd have to go back and look at the actual trade records.
Trying to figure out a good way to ask this question. Okay, so were you a part of the December 2006 meeting with David Vanier and getting closer to home that's been publicized?
No, I did not attend that meeting.
Okay. Was it ever communicated to you after the meeting that you know, did that influence your business going forward in 2007? As far as retaining position and CDEC exposure, so.
I don't recall the date of the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
It was in December of
December 14th, 2006.
Maybe another way of that was Abacus transactions part of the way to get closer to home.
Right, that's what I was searching
for. No, I wouldn't, you know, characterize it that way. I don't recall that we did Abacus transactions as a result of that meeting.
I mean,
did you do Abacus transactions in order to find shorts for Goldman Sachs?
Well, in every Abacus transaction, we were, in the first instance, the protection buffer. So I'm not sure that...
Generally speaking, was your goal to be net flat?
Are you speaking with respect to my trading book or other parts of the business? The correlation trading desk?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, my sense of my mandate from the department management was to be generally balanced with respect to the risks that we took in the correlation trading book. I can't speak to other books that I didn't, you know in detail.
And there was no change in direction. There was no change in objective.
Well, I'm referring to the period up until the early part of 2007, the very early part of 2007. And the reason for that is over the course of 2007, I want to make sure I address your question, that I'm answering the right question. So can you repeat it for me for a second?
Was the objective in managing the correlation book to be net flat?
Okay.
And did that change over time?
Right.
At any time?
That's what I thought you said. I just want to make sure I heard it correctly. We, in 2007, you know, other than the trades we noted, right, the ACA trade, the AC1 trade, where the net result was we became longer, we, in the over the course of the second half, the May, June, and subsequent period of 2007, observed that our book was becoming shorter as a result of the drop in the market. Right? Not because we were doing new trades, but because the tranches were repricing as a result of the market distress. And so we were actually, my recollection is that in the course of 2000, we actually were a net buyer of subprime in our book in an attempt to rebalance our book, but that we were not sufficiently able to repurchase enough EBX to remain flat.
Was the general locus of ABX trading your book?
No.
Which other book was it?
Well, we had an ABX market making desk.
It was separate.
It was part of the structured product trading group, but it was distinct from the structured correlation desk.
Can we just take a 2-minute break?
Sure.
I don't know about all of the problems.